This is what the Lord has said in Psalm 40, a psalm of David. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined unto me and heard my cry. He brought me up also out of an horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings. And he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear and shall trust in the Lord. Blessed is that man that maketh the Lord his trust and respecteth not the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies. Many, O Lord my God, are thy wonderful works which thou hast done, and thy thoughts which are to usward. They cannot be reckoned up in order unto thee. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered. Sacrifice and offering thou didst not desire. Mine ears hast thou opened. Burnt offering and sin offerings hast thou not required. Then said I, Lo, I come. In the volume of the book it is written of me. I delight to do thy will, O my God. Yea, thy law is within my heart. I have preached righteousness in the great congregation. Lo, I have not refrained my lips, O Lord. Thou knowest. I have not hid thy righteousness within my heart. I have declared thy faithfulness and thy salvation. I have not concealed thy loving kindness and thy truth from the great congregation. Withhold not thou thy tender mercies from me, O Lord. Let thy loving kindness and thy truth continually preserve me. For innumerable evils have compassed me about. Mine iniquities have taken hold upon me, so that I am not able to look up. They are more than the hairs of mine head, therefore my heart faileth me. Be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Let them be ashamed and confounded together that seek after my soul to destroy it. Let them be driven backward and put to shame that wish me evil. Let them be desolate for a reward of their shame that say unto me, Aha, aha. Let all those that seek thee rejoice and be glad in thee. Let such as love thy salvation say continually, The Lord be magnified. But I am poor and needy, yet the Lord thinketh upon me. Thou art my help and my deliverer. Make no tarrying, O my God, to the chief musician. And may the Lord bless the reading of his word to our hearts today. As we have already noticed, Psalm 38 through 41 mention the sin of the psalmist. This is the overall connection of these psalms. Psalm 38 and 39 both express so clearly the troubles that have arisen in the life of the psalmist because of his sins. God sent his chastening hand against him and drove the psalmist to his knees in repentance and prayer, seeking God's mercy. But as we begin to look into Psalm 40, we will see that the speaker has a different perspective in this psalm. Yes, the speaker is suffering, but he seems more focused on the praise of God and his obedience to the Lord than on his suffering. These elements give a more positive color to the psalm than Psalms 38 and 39, which were more consumed with the psalmist's despair and pleas for God's mercy. In fact, as we introduce this psalm today, we will have to question whether it is really the speaker's sin which has brought him to his present need for God's deliverance. And we will see why this question is even raised as we look into the psalm itself. As we look for connections between Psalm 40 and the previous psalm, the only real connection between the two psalms seems to be the sin mentioned and the speaker's need for God's mercy to save him. These are general connections of thoughts, and not much in the way of specific words and phrases. Again, the psalm title may be another factor in the organizer's decision in putting Psalm 40 after 39. Psalms 38, 39, 40, and 41 all have a Psalm of David at their head. rather than simply of David or a prayer of David or some other such title. So the organizer has these four psalms together as a subgroup under the larger group of Davidic psalms. And it seems that the organizer focused on the specific wording of the psalm title and the more general aspect of the speaker's sin in seeking God's mercy to decide to place Psalm 40 after Psalm 39. To focus on the meaning of the psalm title, we find that it was a psalm written by David in the prescript and sent to the chief musician in the postscript in order for its use in the public worship in the tabernacle temple situation. As we consider an outline of Psalm 40, it breaks up into two parts. Verses 1 through 4 give the speaker's praise of God. In these verses, we see that he was rescued by God in the past. He also shows concern in his praise to direct the people away from idols to the worship of the one true God. The second section of the psalm begins in verse 5, when the speaker turns from speaking to the people to pray to God. He begins his prayer with the glorious praise of God in verse 5. In verses 6 through 10, the speaker's faithfulness to God is clearly evidenced. It is this section which raises important questions about this psalm, as several verses are attributed to Jesus Christ in the book of Hebrews. Is the speaker, therefore, David or Jesus Christ? How does this psalm apply to their lives? Then the third and final section of the prayer is verse 11 to the end of the psalm. Here we see for the first time that there is any present distress about which the speaker is concerned. Everything up to verse 11 has only been of a positive outlook, and so the contrast we have already made between this psalm and Psalms 38 and 39, where the focus of the psalms were leaned heavily upon the psalmist's misery under the chastening hand of God. So in moving from the second section of the prayer, which expresses the psalmist's faithfulness to God, we see how his faithfulness is used as a basis for the final section's pleas that God would act to save his servant from the trouble he is facing. It is in this final section of the psalm that we also find another intriguing find of which to take note. We have another occasion of what I have called inspired borrowing on the part of David. David on occasion seems to use a verse or several verses from one psalm and with some changing of words places it into another psalm. In Psalm 40 we find verses 13 through 17 being almost word for word the same as the entirety of Psalm 70. So we have an occasion of inspired borrowing in Psalm 40. This case of inspired borrowing is interesting for a few reasons. First, one of the most significant changes in the two passages is the change of God's name in it. In three situations, the name of God is changed to Elohim, or God, in Psalm 70, though in the final situation, God is actually changed to Jehovah in Psalm 70. The effect of these name changes is that Jehovah is more numerous in Psalm 40 and Elohim, or God, in Psalm 70. This has significance for the major breaks of the Psalter, which we have mentioned before, and which we will have to consider more carefully as we come to the end of Book 1 of the Psalter. Psalm 40 has Jehovah as the dominant name and fits into the first book well, which has Jehovah as dominant in all of its psalms. But with the names changing mostly to Elohim in Psalm 70, Psalm 70 fits well in the second book of the Psalter, which is Elohim dominant. The final section of the Psalter switches back to Jehovah dominant. So David's changes by use of his inspired borrowing help us to see purpose in the layout of the whole Psalter. Secondly, this inspired borrowing between Psalms 40 and 70 gives further proof of orphan psalms, or psalms which have no title, originally being one with the psalms which precede them. In this case, Psalm 71, not having a title, would be united to Psalm 70. In observing the connection between Psalms 40 and 70 with the borrowing situation, we can also observe connections between Psalms 40 and 71. For example, we can see the obvious similarities between Psalm 40 verse 5, which says, "Many, O Lord my God, are thy wonderful works which thou hast done, and thy thoughts which are to usward. They cannot be reckoned up in order unto thee. If I would declare and speak of them, they are more than can be numbered." And if we compare this to Psalm 71 verse 15, which says, "My mouth shall show forth thy righteousness and thy salvation all the day, for I know not the numbers thereof." This and other similarities of Psalm 40 with both Psalms 70 and 71 make a further proof that the similarities are actually with Psalm 40 and the united Psalm 70-71. Now, the big question in the interpretation of Psalm 40 is whether the speaker of Psalm 40 is David or Jesus Christ. Why do we ask this question concerning Psalm 40? Well, David is clearly the author in the title. But as we have seen several times already in the Psalms, just because David is in the title, it does not mean that David is the principal speaker in the Psalms. There are times when the Spirit of Christ is speaking his thoughts and words through the penman, which words do not or cannot apply to the penman at all. But of course, we have seen other times when the words of the psalm can apply in some respect to David, yet even more fully to Christ. And there are other times when what is said seems to apply well to the author, but very little to what we know of Christ. Paul helps to settle this question for us by quoting verses 6 through 8 as being spoken by Jesus Christ in Hebrews 10. "Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, Sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body hast thou prepared me. In burnt offering and sacrifices for sin thou hast had no pleasure. Then said I, Lo, I come. In the volume of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God." With one commentator, we must agree that unless Paul, led by the Holy Spirit, attributed Psalm 40, verses 6 through 8, to Christ and his sacrifice of himself, probably no one would see its application to him. But since the Spirit of God so led, there is no room to question its application. And after seeing the Holy Spirit's application of these verses to Christ, its obvious appropriateness is unquestionable. When we see such a Christological application, specifically to Christ's sacrifice in contrast to animal sacrifices, we see that verses 6 through 8 cannot be applied to David or anyone else, but Christ alone. But is the whole psalm of Christ? That question still needs to be answered. Well, if we consider the whole psalm to be of Christ, we immediately have the question of the speaker's sin, which is mentioned in verse 12. Christ was perfectly sinless, but the speaker says in verse 12, "For innumerable evils have compassed me about. Mine iniquities have taken hold upon me, so that I am not able to look up. They are more than the hairs of mine head, therefore my heart faileth me." How can a sinless Christ mention his iniquities as having taken hold of him? Albert Barnes, in his commentary, explains that the Hebrew word for iniquities has the other meaning of troubles. He notices that the parallel word evils can also mean disasters and troubles, not necessarily moral evils. Though Barnes is wrong that iniquities can mean troubles, his reasoning can still be held up with the understanding that the Hebrew word does have the sense of punishment for iniquities. So instead of Christ's iniquities, he was speaking of the punishment he was suffering for iniquities, of course being the punishment for the sins of his people, which he suffered on the cross. Concerning the connection of Psalms 38 through 41, this understanding would only require the change from all these psalms speaking of the psalmist's sins to all these psalms speaking of the psalmist's punishment because of sins, not necessarily his own. Nevertheless, I think that Christ can very well speak of his sin in the sense of the sins attributed to him, though he did not commit them. If Paul goes so far as to say that Christ was made sin in 2 Corinthians 5:21, which says, "For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin," then certainly Christ could speak of his sin, which was placed on his account, the punishment of which he was obligated to pay in full. So Psalm 40's mentioning mine iniquities would not hinder Christ from speaking the whole psalm, and the whole psalm's application being to Christ. Further, it seems clear that, as with Psalm 22, Christ in Psalm 40 is speaking from the cross, or at least in a progression starting near the cross that leads ultimately to the cross. In verses 1 through 3, Christ speaks of his past deliverance from an inescapable situation. This we will take to be poetic of any of the life-threatening situations Christ found in his life. In verses 6 through 8, Christ speaks of the sacrifices of the Old Covenant being insufficient to please God. So he is coming in obedience to perform the perfect sacrifice, which will alone please the demands of God's justice and take away the sins of his people. In verses 9 and 10, Christ speaks of his past preaching ministry before the great assemblies of the people. In the final section, Christ speaks of the present distress of the cross and death. Depending on how we interpret verse 12, we could either see Christ engulfed by the sins of his people, attributed to him, or engulfed by the punishment due to such sins. He seeks God's speedy deliverance and victory over his enemies, the religious leaders and Jews who confidently say, "Aha, aha," as they claim their victory for themselves with the impending death of Christ. So it is with Christ, suffering on the cross itself, we see the full application of Psalm 40. And definitely with Christ, we see the speaker of Psalm 40 saying, "I come to do your will, O my God." So let us examine what the Spirit of Christ speaks for our understanding and edification in Psalm 40. In verses 1 through 4, we have the first section of the psalm. Here Christ is focused on the praise of God. The praise of God mentioned in these verses has continuing significance for the prayer of the psalm. Christ begins his prayer with glorious praise of God in verse 5. He recounts in verses 9 and 10 his faithfulness to preach of God in the great congregation. And even in the third section, we find the continuing emphasis on praise by Christ, as even in the midst of his despair, he is concerned that those who seek God's salvation would say, "Let Jehovah be magnified." So as we noted before, there is distinct emphasis on praise in Psalm 40. Now, Christ demonstrates this praise first by recounting the past deliverance God gave him in verses 1 through 3. Verse 1 reads, "I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined unto me and heard my cry." The psalm opens with emphasis on the first words translated, "I waited patiently." This phrase is made of just two words with the same root in the Hebrew. More literally, it would be, "To wait, I waited." But the emphasis is properly built up in the translation, "I waited patiently." Here we have the determined patience of the servant to wait for his God to act on his behalf. He was not going to pray to any other for help. He would wait and wait and wait some more if he had to. because he was confident that Jehovah alone could save him, and would save him. And as verse 1 indicates, such persistent waiting by faith was rewarded. God did incline himself to hear what his servant was crying to him. God was faithful to hear his prayer, and of course, in that God heard, victory and deliverance was assured, as we will see in verse 2. But let us take the time to focus on the wording of verse 1, in that God inclined himself to the servant. Though prayer is relatively simple for us to speak to God, it requires the God of the universe, who sits as king over heaven and earth, to incline himself, bend himself low, to humble himself, to hear our frail cries for help. Yet though he must humble himself, as our Father, he loves to do so. He even commands us to bring our prayer to him. Yet the irony still remains that we who have the simpler task of merely asking desire to pray less than the God who needs to humble himself more. So as we notice this wording that God inclined himself to the servant, let us renew our appreciation for God's work and faithfulness to humble himself and hear our prayers. And let us renew our determination to take full advantage of our privilege of prayer as children of the God who rules over all. Now we see the result of this persistent waiting for Jehovah and of Jehovah's hearing Christ's cry for help in verse 2. He brought me up also out of an horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet upon a rock and established my goings. God acted decisively to save his servant. We find in this verse that the trouble Christ was in is described as an horrible pit and miry clay. This is not meant to be taken literally. Neither David nor Jesus Christ, according to what is recorded of them, were ever trapped in such a situation. But just as the psalmists speak elsewhere of floods that overcame them, so here the trouble mentioned is merely poetic of a trapped and desperate situation. The horrible pit is more literally a pit of roaring. The roaring evidently refers to roaring water, as its parallel phrase mentions miry clay or muddy mire, which is brought about by the water mixing with the dirt. The picture is that of a pit with an underground river flowing through it and thick mud on the bottom. Dalich says that such a situation is not in nature, and he may very well be right. But we must remember that the Psalms are poetic works, not always meant to have a literal meaning. And certainly with this seemingly impossible picture, Christ shows his desperate plight and God's ability to save him from it. In removing his servant from the mud and roaring waters, God places his feet upon a rock. The last phrase is, "and establish my goings." But the word goings can mean footsteps. So essentially, the phrase reiterates what was said in the previous phrase. He set my feet upon a rock and established my footsteps. His feet were removed from slimy mud, which gave him no firmness to stand upon, and were placed upon a solid rock, where every step he took was made secure. From this poetic expression of God's deliverance, we can see Christ in the various predicaments with his enemies, which, humanly speaking, could easily have swept him away without any security. We may offer, for example, when Herod sought to kill Jesus as just a toddler, or when the Jews sought to throw him over the edge of the cliff. But because of God's guidance and deliverance, Christ was removed from such situations and found every step to be secured by his God. In verse 3 we read, "And he hath put a new song in my mouth, even praise unto our God. Many shall see it and fear, and shall trust in the Lord." Here Christ responds with praise to God saving him from his deadly predicament. Praise, by the way, which Christ attributes to God as the one who put it in his mouth. Even praise, as simple as it may be, cannot be accomplished by the saint without God's help. And as Christ said later of himself, without me, you can do nothing. And so even praise is from the hand of God, that it may be offered back to him as he truly deserves it. Now many believers today would take this phrase, a new song, as a biblical command to sing new hymns, though not inspired by God, to be sung in the worship of God. In response, first, this is to contradict Paul's teaching. In Ephesians 5:18-19, and then also Colossians 3:16, Paul teaches that we are to sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. These can only be identified as inspired songs, those psalms of the Book of Psalms. Because in these parallel passages, the believers are to use these songs to be first filled with the Spirit in Ephesians 5:18, and then secondly, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in Colossians 3:16. So the filling of the Spirit and then having the words of Christ dwell in you richly. This is only explainable in understanding the Spirit of Christ speaking in these psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. And with the words of the Spirit of Christ taught, heard, and sung, the Spirit would fill the Christian with his words, and Christ's words would dwell richly in their hearts. So this command to sing a new song cannot in any way imply the singing of uninspired songs in the worship of God to the contradiction of Paul's commands. But then secondly, we must not attribute just any fanciful meaning to the phrase new song, which certainly can be applied in many ways depending on how the interpreters wish to understand it. New song, for example, does not mean spiritual or religious song as opposed to the secular songs of the world. Certainly those who are spiritually mature will recognize how contrary the words of the world's songs are to a new song which gives praise of God leading to righteousness. But the command to sing a new song is not meant to be a polemic against singing worldly songs, nor is the song called a new song because it was never written before. It is called a new song in the sense of being renewed in the heart of the one who sings it. Dalich correctly defines a new song, saying, a new song is one which, in consequence of some new mighty deed of God, comes from a new impulse of gratitude in the heart. And we see how perfectly this understanding fits the situation of Psalm 40, and Christ responding with this new song after being delivered by God. So it is a new song in the sense of being a renewed song, one that has been sung before, but is renewed in the heart in the present situation of being delivered yet again by God. I think also Plummer's comment here is both simple and profound when he says, a song is the consummation of a deliverance or victory. A song is the consummation of a deliverance or victory. How did Moses celebrate the victory at the Red Sea? With a song. How did Deborah celebrate their victory over Sisera and his army? With a song. A song, at least for the ancient Israelites, was a natural expression of joy in praising God for the deliverance he brought to them. And so the new song very well may be an old song, but one that is renewed in the heart of the singer as he praises God for the new victory that he has accomplished. The last phrases of verse 3 read, many shall see it and fear and shall trust in the Lord. What the many see is how wonderfully God delivers his servant, or possibly Christ singing the praises of God for his deliverance. In other words, they see Christ giving praise to God. With the seeing of this, the many respond with fear of the God who is able to deliver his servant so powerfully and decisively. And certainly with this fear comes the humbling of one's heart before such a powerful and wonderful God. And then also they respond with faith, trusting in Jehovah. As we go on to verse 4, we find Christ, the preacher of righteousness, leading the people to turn from idols unto Jehovah. He says, "Blessed is that man that maketh the Lord his trust and respecteth not the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies." Again, we hear the Psalms identify the one who is blessed. The Hebrew word, as in Psalm 1:1 and elsewhere, is in the plural, indicating the fullness and completeness of blessednesses which such a man is found to have. The word for man in verse 4 is unique. We have seen it before in the Psalms, but it is not the general word for man, mankind. It has the idea of man in an excellent form, commonly to indicate a hero in battle, or maybe a noble or rich man in status. In other Psalms, it seems that his excellence is found not in his fighting prowess or in his nobility, but rather in his righteousness. And this seems to be the case in Psalm 40. The excellence of this man is found in his righteousness. In fact, it seems that his excellence in righteousness derives from how this man is further described as making the Lord his trust and respecting not the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies. As we look at the latter phrase, respecting not the proud, nor such as turn aside to lies, the verb respecting is literally turning. The King James sees this turning to these wicked men as giving respect to them. But probably the phrase is more in line with Psalm 1:1, where how we physically place our bodies with such men ultimately leads not to just giving respect to them, but to our joining them in their sin. As we saw in Psalm 1, "Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful." So Psalm 40 speaks of the blessings of the man who does not turn to the proud and those turning aside to lies. Those who this blessed man do not turn to are first said to be proud, and then secondly, those that are turning aside to lies. The word lies is actually singular, just a lie. As the verb turning aside can indicate turning to apostasy, a lie is probably to be identified not with what comes out of your mouth, but rather a lie being an idol or a false god. This is more the case as we see Christ in the previous phrase teaching the blessedness of the one who makes Jehovah, the one true God, his trust. We can say that weak men, in contrast to the man of excellence in this verse, turn to these wicked men seeking their self-worth. Weak men find some self-veneration and dignity in the praise of such wicked men, or simply in joining in their group, being a part of the crowd. But a man who is truly found to be excellent finds his excellence and his multitude of blessings, as this verse indicates, in trusting in God. So we see, even from these opening words of Psalm 40, the emphasis the psalmist has upon the praise of God. And we also see the end result of such praise to be the conversion and faith of the people of God. Christ is clearly interested in turning the people away from false hopes and idols to the true faith in God. These opening verses, which we have looked at, are not meant to just tell us a nice story of salvation, nor even to merely give honor to the God who saves his people, but also for the specific evangelical purpose of turning the hearts of the people unto God in conversion. Looking further into the psalm, These opening verses are just an example of how faithfully the servant has been to give praise to God in the great congregation. How uniquely perfect Jesus Christ was at fulfilling this service to his God. He drew the multitudes to correct their errors, to instruct them in righteousness, to lead them to truth, to lead them to God. And though we have fallen, and undoubtedly will continue to fall far short of his perfect evangelism, let us renew our determination to speak boldly what God has done for us in both eternal salvation and day-by-day deliverance, so that many shall see and fear and trust in Jehovah.